Just a little bit, I'll be sharing with you out of Matthew, the 28th chapter, beginning with the 18th verse. While you find your place there, I want to introduce some special folks that are that have come this morning to worship here. You know Matthew and Cindy, my son and my daughter-in-law, and their two little boys, Michael and Samuel. But my daughter Michelle is also, she's come this morning from Longview, and her husband Chase, and Chase's father, Rod, and his mother, Rhonda Bullard, are here this morning. And I'm so thankful for them to be here. It's a real encouragement. They've driven all the way from Longview, Rod and Rhonda did this morning in the rain, to be here to worship together with us. And so I'm thankful for that. I'm thankful to this church for the opportunity to be able to just to be here and to share, for this opportunity to share my heart this morning with you and share about challenge you towards missions. But before I do that, I want to just simply say thank you. I know through the years there's some of you, we've been missionaries. Our next month, on the 16th of April, will be our 29th anniversary being missionaries with the International Mission Board. Some of you have been supporting missions longer than that, and you've prayed for missionaries, and you've been giving a lot of even Christmas offering. You've been giving your tithes and your offerings to this church and through the cooperative program. Much of that comes to the International Mission Board to support the work that we do. And we could not be where we are doing what we do if you weren't here doing what you do, and if you weren't faithful at it, and if some of you hadn't been faithful through all these years, we could not have had the ministry we've been able to have. And as I come to share with the Southern Baptist Church, with a missions heart that gives and supports missions and has through the years, I can't say anything unless I say thank you for that. And special thank you for having that mission house. I don't know, I'm sure there are some that exist, but I do not know of any church that has a mission house that they reached a decision to go out and buy a plot and build a house, to be a new house, and furnish it with new furnishings for missionaries to come and live in. A lot of churches have mission houses, but I've never come across one yet that had built that house for that purpose. It has been huge for Matthew and Cindy to be there with Michael and Samuel while we were in Texarkana. They had Michael and Samuel were born while they were going their term half a world away from us. You know, New Boston isn't far from Texarkana at all compared to that. And we've been able to come in, and I can't tell you what it means to drive up that driveway and see little Michael come out with a smile on his face. And to be that close and to be able to repeat that time and time again. If y'all didn't have that mission house there, we'd be in South Carolina or Dallas or somewhere else. And we would still be seeing them, but we wouldn't have been having the experience we've had of being this close and spend days every week with our grandsons and with our son and our daughter-in-law and being able to have this time with them. It's been so special. Thank you. Thank you for doing that. And having that possible, having that house there that makes that possible, it just, I can't say how huge that is in our lives at this time and how wonderful this has been. Jesus came to them and said, "All authority in heaven and on earth has been given to me. Therefore, go and make disciples of all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father, the Son, and of the Holy Spirit, and teaching them to obey everything I have commanded you, and surely I am with you always to the very end of the age." You know, I worked on a message out of this passage of Scripture this week, and I tell you, it's hard for a missionary to preach a short sermon out of the Great Commission passage. My heart is so full. There's so many things I want to share. And after 28 years on the field, 29 years almost, then I've got a lot of things to talk about. I tried to work this message up, and I was going to give a real good detailed analysis of the Great Commission and share the stories I had to plug into it and everything. The problem was the shortest I could get it this week was 80 minutes. I can get away with that in Zambia. People wouldn't hardly blink at that, but New Boston, Texas, I knew I would be in trouble, and I would finish by myself most likely. So I've had to really boil it down to bare essentials. And I basically came down to one word I just want to leave resounding in your ears this morning. It's the word go. It could be debated what Jesus' central command was, but I like to choose the word go as what I boil this passage down to, because it's hard for us to not understand any part of go, isn't it? We know what that means. Now, we can talk about what it means to disciple people and what it means, the different ways of baptizing people and what it means to teach, all the things he's commanded, and all of that can be debated and talked and discussed, and we can really get complicated. But go is just as simple as it gets. Your track season's coming up, and a few weeks there'll be some guys in starting blocks here at the school on the track. The starting pistol goes off. Nobody on that line in those starting blocks will be wondering what that was or what it means or deciding if they should go a little bit or go a lot or what. They'll know that the time has arrived to do what they've come to that place to do, to go. You pull up to a red light, you stop. When the light turns green, most people know that means go. Now, I've run into some people in Texarkana that think it means finish your text message that you're doing and then go, but we know what that means. Go is simple. It calls us to action. And Jesus came to his followers. There were the 11 that remaining disciples that were there, and some believe that the 500 Paul refers to that Jesus appeared before were here at this place in Galilee as Jesus appeared to them on the mountain. And Jesus is saying his last words among the last things he would say to his followers. And we can know that that's important. If I knew that I was going to die, or I knew I was going to be taken away and would never be able to see my family again, the things that I would choose and my final word to them would be the things that rode the most heavy on my heart, more important to me than anything else. And when Jesus knew he was finishing the verbal words he would say in the risen flesh on this earth to those followers, he chose to say these words and similar words to these in the first chapter of Acts. And you and I can know that as we go into our finish our day today, and as you get up and go to work or go to school or whatever you're doing, these words should resound in your ear as the heart, as the center of what God's will is for that time in your life as you go and do what you do. Jesus calls us day in and day out. Every Christian, everyone who names the name of Christ, not just missionaries and not just preachers or pastors or church leaders, but each and every believer, his call to us every day that we live, it should be the overriding principle in our lives, is that Jesus has called us to go to the nations and make disciples. Now, of course, New Boston is part of the nations. And where you go in New Boston or in Bowie County, and as you go to work and do what you do, an overriding concern of yours, over making a living as you go to work, or over getting an education as you go to school, or over buying groceries as you go to shop, there ought to be an overlying principle in your life as a follower of Jesus Christ that here's the call to go to the nations and be making disciples. And the way that you live that day, and the way that you behave, and the way that you respond to people, and the way that you speak, and the way you take advantage of opportunities to share the good news of Jesus Christ and a testimony about what he's done in your life should be there as a top concern in your life as you go and make disciples of all the nations, including New Boston, Texas. Jesus said, go. And he said, go to the nations. And I'm here this morning to share with you as a missionary. And so I want to really emphasize those other places beyond Bowie County and beyond Texas and beyond America, those nations. You know, when Jesus said, go to the nations, he used a word here, is the word, Greek word, ethnos. It's where we get our word ethnic from. And usually when we read that word nation, we're thinking of a political, geographical place like the United States of America, a nation, or Canada, the nation, or Mexico, a nation, or France, or Germany. But what Jesus is talking about here, what this word really refers to, is people who are connected to each other in culture and language. And sometimes a nation might have many of these ethnos, many of these people groups, as we call them. In Zambia, where we serve, and we've served most of these years that we've been on the field, there are 72 ethnos, or people groups, in Zambia. And what Jesus is saying is that we cannot say we finished the job until all of those people groups, there is a process of disciple making. There are people who have responded to the gospel and are reproducing the gospel in the life of others. And disciples are being made until that is happening among all the nations throughout the world. We cannot say we finished our task. And the call of Jesus should continue to resound loudly in our hearts and our minds to go. Missiologists tell us that there's something like 6,500 people groups in the world, these ethnos groups, among whom we cannot say we have really made disciples today. About half of those, we cannot even say that we know that there's anybody there trying to make disciples. That represents about 2 billion people in this world that haven't heard of Jesus and basically have no one to tell them. And the voice of Jesus cries to us today, as even as it did to those disciples 2,000 years ago, go and make disciples. Some of us go by taking our families and moving and taking our lives to another place and living there among that culture, among that people group, and seeking to be a witness and share the gospel with them and make disciples directly. Others are called to go through praying and through giving. But the urgent call in each and every one of our lives today is to go. Now, some things that we need to know about going, as Jesus calls us to do here. One is, we can be sure that what Jesus is calling us to do is no easy task. It's difficult. It's hard. It can be dangerous. It's going to hurt. This is kind of inferred, the way that Jesus started his commission off. He comes and he says, all authority in heaven and earth has been given to me. I used to all just pass over that when I read the Great Commission or preached from it. I assumed that Jesus was saying he had the right to tell us to go. And he does, and that is in there. But I really don't believe that's what Jesus is getting at here. This is something far more significant and far deeper. Jesus says, it's astounding, the claim he makes, all authority in heaven and on earth is given to me. This is something new. Jesus never said that before his death and his resurrection. But he appears as the risen Christ, and he makes the claim. It's almost as though he is saying that all of the authority that has been existing in the world, all of the authority that has been existing in heaven, all of that has been gathered and bundled and placed in my hands. Therefore, go. To really understand that, we have to go back to the Genesis, the third chapter. And there we see the perfect world and the perfect man and woman that God had created and placed in this world being tempted by Satan and yielding to that temptation. And what happens is what we call the fall. Without trying to explain what I can't explain, and I certainly don't have time to try to explain this morning, let me just say that as the result of the fall, of course, sin entered the world. It entered into the lives of mankind. But something else that happened is Satan gained the right, the authority to rule in the hearts and lives of mankind. Jesus refers to Satan three times in the book of John as the prince of this world. Paul writes in 2 Corinthians, the fourth chapter, the fourth verse, referring to Satan as the god of this world who has blinded their eyes. You see, what happened in Genesis and what continued to happen through the thousands of years that preceded that until Jesus came upon this earth was that Satan began to rule not only in the hearts and minds of mankind. He began to shroud their hearts and to shroud their minds in darkness. And he began to shape the cultures and the worldviews of the ethnos of all these different peoples. And even begin to shape their religions and all of that design to blind man to God and to his reality and to his love and to his goodness and to make the darkness even deeper where the light became so difficult for it to penetrate it. And Satan ruled. Then Jesus came and he died upon the cross, and he took the penalty for all of that darkness and all of that failure and all of that rebellion through all of those years, all the way to the end of the earth. He took it upon himself, and he won the victory so that he could stand before his followers that day and say, all authority is now given to me. All the authority in heaven, all of the authority in earth, all of the authority that Satan has used to darken and blind and control and rule over the lives has been given to me. Go. I have the right. I have earned the authority to go back into Satan's kingdom, to go back into the hearts where Satan rules, and to claim back that which belonged to God by creation, that which belonged to God by his love and his concern, to claim it back for his kingdom. Go. I'm reminded of the police dramas you see over and over on television and in movies. You know, you got the bad guys have done whatever they've done, and they have whatever they have, and the police know who they are, they know where they are, they know the contraband they have, and they need to go get it. They need to go make the arrest. They need to go take care of this problem. They need to eradicate this evil thing that exists because of what the bad guys are up to. But they can't, because there's legal protocol. And they can't go there, and they can't kick in doors, and they can't make an arrest, they can't do anything until the judge gives them a warrant. And so the drama is that the time is passing, and if they don't get it done, it's going to be too late. And they wake the judge up in the middle of the night, and they finally convince him to sign the warrant, and the officer comes into the room, and he says, I got it, guys. I've got the warrant. Go. And they go, and they kick in doors, and they make the arrest, and justice is served. But you know something that this tells us, the way that this tells us that this is going to be hard, is that you never see the police drama where the guy gets the warrant and walks up to the bad guy's door and rings the bell, and they open the door and says, hey, you know, here's the warrant. I've got it. You guys, come on out. You know what's up now. Yeah, go ahead and give me the stuff. Come on out and get in the car. Put these handcuffs on. We're going to go to jail. I've got the warrant. That settles it. It doesn't happen that way. They go in there with a bulletproof vest, weapons drawn. They got SWAT teams on the rooftops around there. They got guns pointed at the windows and the doors. They go to the back door and the front door. They coordinate everything. They kick in the doors and they go in yelling for people to get on the floor. It's dangerous work, and people can get hurt, and people can get killed, and they go prepared. And when Jesus stands before his disciples and he stands before us this morning and says, go kick in the doors of darkness, and take back from Satan that which belongs to God. Claim souls back for him. We need to know that Satan does not want to give up what he's ruled for all this time. And it's not going to be easy. And all the obstacles he can place in the way, all the hardships, all everything he can do to discourage the going to the nations and making disciples, he will do. And that makes the task hard. Years ago, we began to discover this. We were in the process. We had applied to the mission board, Foreign Mission Board, and we were in the process and getting ready to come. Everything was going great. We were excited. We thought probably we'd be turned down. They'd find out something about us or something that wouldn't work, or there'd be some kind of a health issue. We'd heard all these stories about people who had their hearts broken wanting to go to the field, feeling called and didn't get to. And everything was shaping up. And we finally decided it was time for us to start talking to our families about this. And so I was pastoring up northeast of Bonham, a little town, a little community called Telephone. And my mom was living in Hooks, and she would drive over to visit with us about once a month or so and spend time with the kids. We'd get to have a date night, and Betty and I would go somewhere, and she'd watch the kids, and we always enjoyed her visit. But one time she came, and we went over to Sherman to a McDonald's, and I thought we were in a public place, and she can't make much of a scene. It's a good time to let her know what we're doing. So we were sitting outside, and they had a playground of McDonald's there, and we were sitting outside. The kids were over there playing. Michelle was, at that time, she would have been 5 years old. Matthew was 3, and Michael was 2. And I said, well, Mom, there's something I need to talk to you about. I said, God's been dealing in our life, and We feel like that he might be calling us to missions. And we're in process. We're talking with the IMB, and everything's going well. It looks like that possibly in the next year we could be going overseas, probably to Africa, to live. My mom was a hero. You know, she never discouraged me in God's will at all. And she said, well, Dwayne, you need to do what you feel like God wants you to do. We kind of talked about where we were talking about going and what it would be like and stuff. And my mom got quiet. She looked over at the playground. And she looked back and she had tears going down her cheeks. And she said, that means you'll be taking those kids with you, doesn't it? I wasn't ready for that. I wish I had thought about it. I would have said, well, no, Mom, that's the other thing we wanted to talk to you about. But I wasn't quite ready to do that. And I said, yeah, Mama, the kids will be going. I think that's the first time that I saw tears on my mother's cheeks that I knew that a decision I had made had put there. I'm sure they had been there before, but I'd never seen them. And the first time in my life, I knowingly did something that I knew was breaking my mother's heart. You know, they say what goes around and comes around. In just a few weeks, Matthew and Cindy will be getting on an airplane to fly back to the place where God has called them to serve. I don't have to ask. They're going to take those little boys. And they're going to break my heart. See, going is hard. It's difficult. It costs. Just a couple of weeks or so after they leave, Betty and I are going to crawl on a plane. Michelle and Chase gave us a gift of their first little granddaughter since we've been home this time. And we've been there from the time she was born. We've been able to see her develop, and she's at that place where she coos and talks to you and laughs and smiles. And we're going to hug her one last time. We're trying to save money and all, where we'll be able to travel and see Matt and Cindy and come back here and see Harper and Michelle and Michael. But if that doesn't happen, she'll be 4 years old when we see her again. That's hard. I remember we got to the field those years ago. We landed in Lusaka. It'll be 28 years ago this past September. And I remember landing there and being really scared to death. I had no idea what I was getting my family into. We were met at the airport by missionaries. September is a hot time in Zambia, really hot. And so we landed there, and all the heat and everything that we faced, all of a sudden we were in a place where nothing seemed familiar. Language was different, accents were different, smells were different. It was a totally different world. The only thing we were familiar with, the only thing we could really relate to, were missionaries. And we all know how weird those guys are. We spent two nights in the capital, and they gave us a car with a steering wheel on the right-hand side and told me to drive it on the left-hand side of the road, and to load up my family, and we headed to the eastern part of Zambia where we were going to do language. We got there at nighttime after driving on potholes and through mountains and just knowing that I was going to kill us all before we got there, trying to learn to drive that van on the wrong side of the road through all the area that I was so unfamiliar with, the potholes and all of that. We got there at night, went into the house, everything was there. It was outfitted. We had beds. We had, you know, the basic stuff to live in this house that they had set aside for us to do language study in. Getting ready to go to bed, we got the kids in bed, and Betty was staring out a window. And I was trying to put on a real brave face. So I went up and put my hands on her shoulders, and I said, well, we're finally here. Isn't this great? I felt her stiffen. You know, you can stand behind your wife sometime and you can see the expression on her face, even though you're just looking at the back of her head, or in my case, the top of her head. My wife is quite short. She said, did you notice that there aren't any screens on the windows? I had not noticed that. They had put everything else in the house, but there were no screens for the mosquitoes and stuff. So we went through the house and shut windows, went to bed. It was probably 80-something degrees at night in tropical areas like Zambia. There's no insulation in the attics. So all the heat in the attic just began to soak down into the house and just got hotter and hotter and hotter. And we laid there and tried to sleep. And I remember sweating and realizing that as tired as we were not going to get any sleep that night. So I said, well, you know, it's the dry season. I understand it hasn't rained in like 6 months. Surely there's not any mosquitoes. So we went and opened windows in the bedroom. Woke up the next morning, I didn't really notice mosquito bites on me or anything, but went into the children's room, and evidently Michelle was the flavor of the month. She rolled over in her bed, and her eyes were almost swollen shut from the mosquito bites she had on her face. Now, one of the things they had told us about malaria, said you can take the malaria medicine, and you want to take it, they're supposed to prevent it, you want to do all of the right precautions. But the main thing about not getting malaria is don't get mosquito bit. The reverse of that theory or that formula came to me really quick. And I realized I hadn't even been in the country 3 whole days yet, and I'd already made a decision. It could possibly cost the life of one of my children. And going got harder. A couple of weeks later, the Lord blessed, we didn't have any malaria from that incident, but the kids did get sick. Michelle and Michael got sick a couple of weeks later. We went to the missionaries in the town. They said, don't go to the hospital here in town. It's bad. The best hospital in all the eastern part of Zambia is this mission hospital out in the bush that's run by Seventh-day Adventist out there. We went there. There's not time to really share that whole experience. We found out our kids didn't have malaria, but we drove home horrified at what the best medical care in all the eastern side of the Zambia, where we were possibly going to spend the rest of our lives, was like. And I realized that snake bites or malaria, just any number of things could very easily take the life of any of us before we got back home. And going got harder. We began to learn language. I made a commitment to be able to preach in the language in 6 months and stop using interpreters. And I was preaching almost every Sunday. And then finally that time came and I started preaching in the local language, Chinyanja. And I remember standing how many times I stood in the pulpit and I preached my heart out trying to preach. And I could look in those little people in the congregation out under a tree or in a brush shelter somewhere, and I could see in their faces that they did not understand a word I was saying. And what really horrified me is I didn't understand most of what I was saying. And I remember going home depressed, thinking, you know, I left a place where I could preach, and I could preach with freedom, and people understood me, and people's lives were affected by that, and I don't know if I will ever affect anything here. And I'm wasting God's call on my life. And going got harder. We moved to the area where we're going to live, and there's no electricity there. We had a generator that we ran for about 4 hours a day. We'd turn it on when it got dark and turn it off at 9 o'clock at night. Betty would have to plan her meals and all. There was almost nothing to buy in Zambia at that time. We would go to Malawi or Zimbabwe or other countries to buy supplies, and she would buy like 3 months of supplies for food and planning meals and all of that. Most things she had to make from scratch. Everything. She made everything from potato chips to rolling out tacos for Mexican food, whatever we had, she made it pretty much. I always knew Betty was getting homesick because all of her tacos shells or tortillas rolled out to be the shape of Texas. Everything. Took a while to learn how to make those things round. But that was hard. And it wasn't just the living and all the culture shock and all of those adjustments that made it hard, but there was times there was even danger. The roads were dangerous, and the malaria, and seeing our kids get sick and watching them when they did get malaria have that fever and suffer through it, and even having a doctor at one time tell us that our youngest son, Michael, said, if this boy gets malaria one more time, I'm going to write to IMB and tell him, you guys have got to go home or you're going to lose him. Michael never had malaria after that, and we were able to stay, but it was hard. But there was danger. About 10 years ago, I went into an area, and Zambia is really a very peaceful place, but some of our missionaries serve in places that are very dangerous. But I went into an area where we didn't have any work, and I drove in there, and there was a leader of a church that was a kind of a mix of, tried to mix Christianity with animism. And as I went into that area, this guy had spread a rumor that as I was driving through, he said, this guy that's coming in here with Baptist Mission on his car, he's a Satanist. And what he's really doing is he's here to capture children and to use them in rituals. And all these Baptists that he's leaving in other places, they're satanic. And so people were afraid. And I couldn't get any work started in that village. And so I went to another place to start work. And I was driving through that village to get to the other place. And a group of men had the road blocked in front of me. And I started to stop and see what they wanted. And I noticed their hands came out. They all had stones. So I turned and drove. And rocks just began to pelt the truck on the side and the back. The Lord helped me get away from there. But I realized again, I was just reminded that going is hard. It's a difficult task, and it can be a dangerous task. Now, I don't share all that with you just to make it sound like I'm brave or something. I'm not. But I share that with you because we need to understand that people that pick up their lives and go and are doing the task of missions in those places and have gone to live among the nations, live in some hard places, and they're doing a hard thing, and the challenge is great, and many of them are laying their lives on the line. Two-thirds of our mission force right now are living in places where they cannot even let it be known that they're missionaries, because one, it could endanger their lives, it could endanger the lives of people that they reach for Christ, and at the very least they would be thrown out of the country and lose their ministries. And I share all that with you because as God has called you to go through your giving and your praying, I want to challenge you that the giving and the praying that we do ought to at least equalize with the sacrifice of the going that others are doing to be there. And the risk and the hardship should be brought into the way that you give and the way that you pray, so that the sacrifice you make as you give to missions to support it, and as you pray for missionaries, and as you do your part, ought to be equal to the risk that those that God called to move their lives and their families to be there among the nations and share are taking. Go. And it's hard. But you know what? That's not the whole story. Jesus also said, and surely I am with you. I wish there was time to share the many times that we have experienced Jesus being with us in such a just a miraculous kind of way, where he has sustained us and he has taken care of us and he has protected us. Just from the stories I've shared, we never lost a child to a snake bite or malaria or anything else. Our kids all grew up healthy and they're here. Two of them are here, Michael's in Dallas. And they're bringing us grandkids and blessing our lives today. That's true because Jesus was with us, and he sustained us, and he protected us. Jesus was with me that day when the guys had hacked the plan to stone me to death because I was a Satanist. The place where they chose to stop me was just at the only other place I knew in that entire village where I could turn and get away, and I knew where to go. He was with me. But you know, he's not just with us to protect us and to take care of us. But I found through the years he's been with me to use me. Jesus helped me learn the language. And I remember the day when it just dawned on me all of a sudden that I was preaching and I was teaching and I wasn't having to struggle with the language. And I could see understanding in the eyes that I spoke to, and lives were being changed. And somewhere it had transitioned to the point where God was using me. Even as I stumbled my way through Chinyanja, he used me. And even the time where the thing where they tried to stone me happened, I thought I had totally blown that. The chief of that area called a meeting, and we all got together. We took some leaders from the mission, took the leaders from our area, and chief sent representatives, and we went back to that village, and there was a big meeting to try to sort out what had happened. It's a really big deal because the chief had given me his blessings to go there. That's the village he wanted me to be in. So he had really come down on them, and he said, we're going to get this straightened out. And we went out there. Everybody was there. The whole community, all the villages around there came in. And we had this meeting, and we were able to stand up and say, this is who we are. This is why we're here. And several times people gave testimony that shared the gospel at that time. But there was this group over here who had started the rumors, and their leader, and someone would stand up on this side and say, well, this sounds like something we need here. But they would stand over here, and they were very belligerent and very angry. And you could see the division in the community that was coming out of it. And we finished that meeting, and I realized that I had become a lightning rod there, and I would never be able to really go in there and start anything because the division of the community would just come out with my presence in that place. I was asked to go into Lusaka and do a different job and be logistics coordinator and have a responsibility for helping missionaries be set up with houses and the things that they need to do their work all over Zambia. And I'd gone in to do that job, and another family had gone out there to work in that area, and they invited us to come and spend Christmas with them. Now, this about 3 years after this happened. They had been there a little while. And they were still learning their way around. And we went, and we were sitting down for Christmas lunch. And there was a knock at the gate. Somebody was banging on the gate with a rock. And it's not uncommon in the rural areas of Zambia. People don't recognize holidays or anything. And someone had come for business. So the missionary kind of groaned and said, okay, well, I'll be back. And he went out there, opened the gate. He came back in about 30 minutes and sat down to his cold turkey and dressing and started eating. He said, well, you know, I think that might have been worth it. He said, there was a guy out there that he came and he's telling me about a church that he had moved and he had married someone in this village. He was a Christian from over in the Petoke area where we spent the first 10 years that we were in Zambia. And he was a Christian, and he had come and he had married someone, and he had decided there was not a Baptist church there, so he had started a church in this village. And he's come, he said, there's about 20 baptized believers there now. And they're meeting every week, and they want Bibles, so he's come in with money. The church took up a collection to buy Bibles and hymnals and things for them to use. And he was just real excited about this new church that had started. And I thought, well, maybe, you know, I've worked in areas out here. What was the name of the village? So he reached in his pocket and pulled out his notes, and he said, oh, he called the name of the village. It was the village where they tried to stone the missionary because they believed he was a Satanist. And God just reaffirmed that he could use, even when I fall on my face and I feel like I have totally blown it, he's able to use me. And as you do the going Jesus calls you to do, that same assurance is just as real for you. Go. Every person here this morning, Jesus has one of two words to say to you. If you're a believer, if Jesus is your Savior, and there's a time that you committed your heart and your life to him, Jesus' word to you, as we've been saying this morning, is go. He may be calling you to go overseas, to take your family, and to go move among one of those people groups. And that's yourself and your family and your lives and your testimony and your teaching and all the things you do be a light so that there might begin to be disciples made among that people. It may be that Jesus is calling you to go on shorter term commitments and mission trips or other ways to serve in missions in another way in another country among the nations. Jesus may be calling you to come to a new commitment in the way that you pray, in the way that you give, so that your praying and giving and the cost to you is more like the cost that those who go and live face. The call to go. But for everyone that has never received Jesus as their Lord and Savior, the call you this morning is come. We talk about last words and how important they are. The last words attributed to Jesus in the Bible. The Spirit and the bride say, come. Let him who hears say, come. Whoever is thirsty, let him come. And whoever wishes, let him take the free gift of the water of life. If you've never accepted Jesus as your Savior this morning, if you've never come to know him personally, you've never committed your life to him, then way before he will say to you, go, this morning he is saying, come. And I believe much heavier on his heart, much more urgent in his voice is the term when he says, come. Would you come to him this morning? Whatever it is that God has laid on your heart, you're going or you're coming. I encourage each and every person to take care of that this